Okay, looks like everyone is getting settled in. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. We are about to hear our third case. Marshall, please call the next case.
Calling A221008,
Counsel, as you probably know, you will each have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and counsel for appellant, you will have a 5-minute rebuttal. You may use the center podium or you may use either of the side podiums. The timer is available on the center podium. The center podium does move up and down to adjust to your height, so feel free to do that so you're comfortable. And I would ask that each of you introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument with your name and identify the party who you represent so we know how to refer to each of you, and also for the purposes of our audio recording today. So, counsel for appellant, there are 15 minutes on the clock, and you may begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, my name is Christina Zahar, and I represent appellant Michael Lovestrand. This appeal stems from a criminal sexual conduct trial wherein the state's case relied exclusively on the credibility of the alleged victim. Due to the district court's wrongful denial of the defendant's pre-trial parity motion requesting the victim's therapy records, the defense was unable to effectively cross-examine the alleged victim, and Mr. Lovestrand was ultimately and wrongfully convicted of criminal sexual conduct. An abuse of discretion occurs when a district court makes findings unsupported by the evidence or by improperly applying the law. And that is exactly what happened here in the pre-trial parity proceedings. The district court ruled on the defendant's parity motion without citing or analyzing any Minnesota authority on how to conduct a proper parity analysis. And as we know, of course, the parity analysis, it balances the defendant's rights to discovery and the defendant's constitutional rights to a fair trial against an alleged victim's and the state's right to privacy of otherwise confidential records. The district court failed to analyze or consider Mr. Lovestrand's constitutional rights, and this was a clear violation of current Minnesota law and the parity procedure.
So can you just answer, and I assume the Ramirez case is going to come up at some point, but setting that aside, how was your client prejudiced?
He was prejudiced.
As a result, because I didn't see any reference at all to the, I mean, there was a in-camera review by the district court in the post-trial motions, and I guess there were a couple of documents that were they were provided to the parties, right? We don't have them in our record here, but they weren't referenced at all in your brief. So I guess the question is, how was your client prejudiced, even if you're right and we agree with you that there should have been an in-camera review beforehand? And, of course, that's setting aside Ramirez, but go ahead.
Yes, so you're correct that there was a post-trial, based on our post-verdict motions, an in-camera review of the SOT records. And those records are referenced in the briefs. And what they describe is the alleged victim specifically denying being sexually assaulted in July of 2019 on two different occasions. And so that is what the district court found post-trial as being relevant and material to this case. And of course, that would have been critical evidence to present when the state's case relied exclusively on the credibility of this complainant if we're able to question her on actually denying being sexually assaulted a year after the alleged incident and just months before she reported to the police. She also denied being sexually assaulted to the emergency room physician that she saw close in time to the alleged incident. And this would bolster our ability to attack her credibility by maintaining that still a year after the alleged incident, she was denying repeatedly to a professional that she had ever been sexually assaulted. She apparently made the decision that she was sexually assaulted during those meetings with her therapist, and that is why it was so critical in this case. And she testified to that as well. So even though the state successfully suppressed the therapy records that we were seeking, they ultimately used the victim's therapy in their case in chief by asking her questions about going to therapy, and she responded to those questions and explained that it was actually in therapy that she decided that a crime had occurred that she wanted to report. This case involves a very extended timeline where the alleged incident happened in July of 2018, but the reporting does not happen until November of 2019. The therapy denials were July of 2019, and the denial of sexual assault to the emergency room physician was back in July of 2018. So we're talking about an extended timeline where the victim was on record denying any non-consensual sexual contact with the defendant. That would have been extremely material and relevant in this case if we would have been able to have that information to cross-examine the alleged victim. Additionally, we learned post-trial in those records that we sought that the victim wasn't actually in therapy at the time of the alleged incident as she testified. She did not begin therapy until approximately July of 2019, again, about 1 year after the alleged incident, which is in direct contradiction to what she testified, that she had been in therapy at the time and had discussed with a therapist throughout. That is just not true based on the evidence that was obtained post-trial. But we did not have that evidence, of course, during the trial to be able to effectively cross-examine the alleged victim. And if we want to talk about Hope Coalition and Ramirez, I think those cases are important, too, to get to that next point. Those cases were not decided at the time of the parity analysis in this case. So I think that's an important factor to address up front, that this court, the Court of Appeals, is not a fact-finding court. So we're not... I don't necessarily think it's appropriate for that analysis to be done for the first time here. However, for argument's sake, I'm happy to discuss those cases and how they might apply here. And I think what's very different in this case compared to Hope Coalition and compared to Ramirez is there was actual evidence presented in this case pertaining to the victim's conversations with her therapist and those therapy records. And so what those cases tell us is that if we're strictly interpreting the statutory privileges, 595.02, testimony of witnesses, specifically the privileges of medical professionals or psychological professionals, that those privileges can only be overturned or broken if a defendant's constitutional rights outweigh the state's interests and the victim's interests in privacy. And in this case, we have a clear example that distinguishes it from Hope Coalition and Ramirez in that this was actual evidence in the trial. Hope Coalition and Ramirez were both pre-trial proceedings where the agencies that held the privilege objected and filed motions objecting to the piercing of those privileges. We do not have that here. The therapy office, I suppose, did not file any motions or objections to the parity request. The state, of course, objected to our parity request, and they made their arguments why it shouldn't come in, but we do not have an objection from the third-party agency holding the records like we do in Hope Coalition and Ramirez. And because we don't have that objection, we don't even have the factual record needed to determine if one of these statutory privileges even applied in that case. So what we know from the statutory privileges, subdivision 1G, psychologists, consulting psychologists, or licensed social workers hold the privilege when we're talking about therapy records. We do not have factual record in this case that it was a psychologist or licensed social worker that this victim was consulting with. If this victim was consulting with a therapist or a counselor, that person does not fall under that statutory privilege in the strict language of those privileges that is interpreted by Hope Coalition and Ramirez. Because the state did not make that argument. It was pre-Hope Coalition, pre-Ramirez. We don't have any information to indicate what type of professional it was that this victim was speaking with. What we do know is that she had told the police while reporting the offense that she had determined in counseling that what happened to her was rape. She had determined that over a year after the alleged incident occurred. And she made additional statements to the prosecution in preparing for trial that emphasized the importance of therapy and these discussions with her therapist in making the determination to inform police of this offense and report it as a crime. She had gone well over a year not believing a crime had occurred, believing it was a consensual interaction, and that it was simply a bad sexual experience. Those are the words that she used to describe what had happened to her. It's a very unique factual case in that we're talking about consensual vaginal sex initially, and then we're talking about consensual anal sex. The victim agreed it was initially consensual. At some point, the argument is that she withdrew the consent to the anal sex, and that is where the alleged offense would have occurred. At what time or how long thereafter?
But does that legally matter, though? I mean, in terms of whether or not it's rape, if she withdrew consent and she communicated that, that doesn't legally matter, does it, anymore, for what happens from that point after?
Well, the withdrawal of consent is important in a case like this because the jury was instructed that a withdrawal of consent needs to actually be communicated and understood by the defendant in order for the defendant to commit a crime. And so we talk a little bit about that language in the sufficiency of the evidence portion of our brief, but that is why that's important in a case like this. It's not a case where the victim is alleging it was non-consensual during the entire act, which I think is more common in criminal sexual conduct cases. This is a case where the victim agrees it was initially consensual, then it wasn't, and then it was consensual again at the end.
So I agree with you that that is really one of the key points that we need to look at here. And you make the argument that the circumstantial evidence is insufficient to establish that consent was withdrawn. I guess I'm wondering, in terms of the circumstances proved, it's proved that they were in close proximity. It's proved that they were, that she was vocal, that she explained that it hurt, that she said stop, and that he, in fact, then thereafter did not stop. So I think I need a little bit more from you in terms of explaining to me how do we get to a rational hypothesis of innocence based on the circumstances proved in this case?
The rational hypothesis that is not consistent with guilt is that the defendant did not hear or understand her request to stop the contact at that point. What she testified is that she said, "Stop, it hurts," or some variation thereof, approximately 2 to 3 times. She described how she was face down, her face into the mattress. He was behind her and on top of her. She described the TV being on. She knew that they had been conversing previously when they were on the couch. They were face-to-face. Again, when they were on the bed and they were face-to-face, they had been conversing. In fact, they had this conversation about whether or not to have anal sex that she ultimately agreed to try. The question is whether he heard or understand her. If her emphasis was more on it hurts rather than stops, she does describe that he pulled out for a period of time, essentially readjusted, went back in. She said it still hurts at that time. What gets really foggy here is the timeline about when she was saying stop, it hurts, and when he ultimately stopped.
So do you have any authority that says that it's the timeline that matters and we have to look at exactly when consent was withdrawn?
The timeline matters in this case as far as the circumstantial evidence test goes, because what we're looking for is that rational hypothesis that's inconsistent with guilt. And in this case, there is that rational hypothesis that there's only circumstantial evidence that he heard or understood that withdrawal of consent.
Well, as I understand it, she also testified that this went on for at least 5 minutes and she was in significant pain. So you're asking us then to infer that he didn't hear her objecting for 5 minutes.
Well, she testified that she was not shouting. She testified that she only said stop or it hurts 2 to 3 times. So this isn't a case where she's alleging she was shouting or repeatedly and constantly saying stop. She said stop or it hurts approximately 2 to 3 times during that 5 minutes. She doesn't say when that was, and that is why this is circumstantial evidence in this case. It's not direct evidence. She testified that he did not acknowledge what she was saying. He didn't say anything back to her until he ultimately did stop and they returned to vaginal sex, which no longer hurt, is what she testified, and they completed the sex act with vaginal sex and had a normal evening after that, I would say. There was nothing else remarkable about their interaction after that point. And so although it's a, you know, of course, a fact question for the jury, in this case, all we have is circumstantial evidence about that withdrawal of consent. So that's a really critical element in the facts of this case for both criminal sexual conduct counts that he was convicted of, because it requires non-consent.
And counsel, doesn't it also require a credibility determination by the fact finder that we are not allowed to review?
It does require a credibility determination by a fact finder, but not when we're talking about the element of circumstantial evidence. So when we're talking about circumstantial evidence, we look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state's case, which is what the victim testified, right? We need to assume that the jury accepted what the victim testified to. But even looking at what she testified to, we have a gray area or an unknown, and that's where the circumstantial evidence test comes in, where this court will need to determine whether the circumstances proved are consistent with guilt and inconsistent with any other rational hypothesis other than guilt. And in this case, there is a consistent rational alternative hypothesis that that communication was not heard or understood. The victim did not present evidence that that would be direct evidence to that point.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you. My time is up. Thank you.
And next, we will turn to counsel for respondent. Again, feel free to adjust the height of the podium, and just a quick reminder to identify yourself and the party that you represent today. Thank you. You may begin when you are ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm because there is more than sufficient evidence to sustain appellant's convictions. Furthermore, the district court did not err in its Brady or Parity rulings, and the appellant is not entitled to any relief on these claims. Right off the bat, I'd just be happy to answer any questions that the panel has.
I would like to have you address the requirement that there be a plausible showing under the Parity motion that the information sought is material and favorable. What showing was made and why was it deficient?
Sure. So the showing that was made at the pretrial stage is summarized and quoted on page 11 of my brief. And what the appellant at that point stated was that the police reports indicated that the victim is in counseling to process the alleged criminal sexual conduct, and that the victim did not believe a rape had occurred. Clearly, any information the complainant reported to counselors that is contrary to the information she reported to police is material and goes directly to the defense theory of the case. So that's the entirety of the showing that they made. And essentially at this juncture, what was before the court was that the victim, when reporting to the police, told the police, I didn't first think that what happened to me was rape. There was no showing that she gave different information to her therapist, that at any point in time she characterized the encounter as consensual. You know, her story hasn't changed. It's just been sort of her understanding of legally what does this count as, what happened to me. Her initial descriptions to her friend and to her mom, and then obviously later to the police, has been consistent in terms of, I said stop, I said this hurts. He didn't stop, he kept doing it. The people in her life said, hey, that's sexual assault, and, she wasn't very comfortable with that based on the evidence at trial, just kind of, accepting, gosh, is that what that counts as? Is this a sexual assault? Should I be reporting to this to police?
Why shouldn't the defendant be allowed to make the argument that you just made to the jury to distinguish statements made to a counselor? I mean, you've acknowledged that it's, I think your state's acknowledged it's relevant.
Could you say your question again?
The counseling information is relevant. You don't dispute that it's relevant.
I don't know that any showing was ever made that anything said there, was favorable to the defense in terms of materiality. The fact that she went to counseling, that was part of the trial. She mentioned that in her testimony. Obviously, it was mentioned when she went to police as well. Like that is a fact that is part of what happened in this case, is that she sought counseling and then she eventually went to the police to report. And obviously the state elicited very limited testimony at trial that the victim did go to counseling. I just think that, you know, many sexual assault victims go to counseling, and I don't think that renders, you know, the fact that they went to counseling immediately material and relevant for a parody.
Not that she went to counseling. I'm talking about the content of the representation that she told her counselor.
We don't know what she told her counselor other than, I mean, that's really not in the record, other than, you know, post-trial in the parody motion that was litigated, you know, what was disclosed to the parties are these heavily redacted pages, and we have that an intake form basically says the victim denies history of sexual abuse. So it's not, you know, specific to this particular case. You know, I'd say that evidence was certainly in trial that for at least a year she did not say that she had been sexually abused. But I think that, you know, appellant's argument about what this parody evidence is, you know, it's overstating what it is. What we have is what already came in at trial, which is this happened to me. I said no. He kept going. I didn't think of that as sexual assault. I didn't tell anybody that was sexual assault. And then we have, you know, obviously testimony for explaining, for instance, what the medical chart says and what her recollection of what happened at the doctor.
So is it your argument then that the documents that were disclosed post-trial were just redundant? I mean, because she testified and acknowledged that she didn't view it as sexual abuse at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of my argument on prejudice, which is that they certainly asked the victim, you know, these same questions, which was, you didn't even think this, that you were raped. You didn't tell anybody that this was rape, you know, over a period of time. I mean, that is certainly part of my prejudice argument, which is that this exact same information was basically before the jury. The victim even said it wasn't till, you know, at least a year afterwards that she considered it to be sexual assault, what happened to her. So that is certainly part of the prejudice argument, which is, that information, you know, there's two pages that say the victim's name denies history of sexual abuse. The third page, you know, doesn't even have any favorable evidence to appellant, but it does reference, you know, this case in some fashion. So that's certainly part of the argument. I think the other part is that Ramirez and Hope Coalition, I think certainly, although, you know, they weren't out and the district courts didn't have sort of the benefit of that clarity at the time they were making those rulings, you know, they do talk about, for instance, that a defendant has, you know, the right, the opportunity to cross-examine. Like, that's what the Confrontation Clause is about. And here, an argument being made that they could have cross-examined her, you know, better or more effectively. I think that Hope and Ramirez tell us that what you get is an opportunity to cross-examine the victim, and they did. They even were able to cross-examine her basically on this exact same subject matter. And then, obviously, Hope Coalition and Ramirez also point out that, you know, your right to present a defense does not entitle you to privileged documents.
So in light of Hope Coalition and Ramirez, the appellant argues that the victim kind of, the state opened the door to the therapy records. Was the district court correct, and I don't mean to make this an unfair question, but I'll rephrase it. So do Hope Coalition and Ramirez change and make it improper to have granted in-camera review?
I mean, I would think so. I mean, I will acknowledge that we don't have the same kind of record you have in Ramirez or Hope Coalition, where maybe the victim is gets information that she should obtain her own attorney and, you know, take affirmative action to try to, you know, prevent the disclosure of these records. Most victims, when told that a court order is going out, don't, you know, obviously take those kind of actions. I did not argue that in my brief because I didn't know if that was sort of a fair argument to make after the fact, but I certainly think under Hope Coalition and Ramirez that I don't know that Judge Quam's order disclosing these therapy records would really pass sort of that test that's laid out there, which is that these confidential privileged documents, so assuming that they fit under the statute, you know, cannot be pierced without the victim's consent unless, you know, there's sort of a constitutional rights implicated here. And I think Hope Coalition and Ramirez, and I already said this, but they really say that you get an opportunity to confront the victim, and your right to present a defense doesn't mean you get privileged documents. So I don't know that his decision would hold up in light of those cases, but obviously those cases weren't around when either Judge Chu or Judge Quam were making their rulings. But I think they're helpful, at least on sort of the prejudice piece even.
If you could speak to the conversation I was having with your opposing counsel about the sufficiency of the evidence when it comes to consent, that would be helpful. I think that essentially what I'm hearing is that it's a reasonable to infer from the circumstances proved that he did not hear her when she said to stop. And if you could address why that is not reasonable, I think that would be helpful to us.
Sure. As I outlined in my brief, the state's position is that the victim's testimony that she said no repeatedly, loudly, and clearly is direct evidence that she had withdrawn her consent. So as a preliminary starting point, you know, the state framed the argument in the, you know, direct evidence test. However, if we want to look at it under the circumstantial evidence test, or if this court determines that's the appropriate analysis, as I outlined in my brief, I think that it's important, obviously, to winnow down to only the circumstances that support the verdict as that first step. And secondarily, I mean, the state's argument is simply that if the evidence is that the victim stated that she repeatedly said stop, she repeatedly said it hurts, that she spoke in a loud and clear voice, that the defendant, you know, heard her every other time she spoke, there is no other rational hypothesis that he didn't hear her. If there was, you know, different evidence, you know, maybe that could be a rational hypothesis. But the state's perspective is the victim testifying that she loudly and clearly and repeatedly said no, that it's not rational to think, oh, I guess he didn't understand that.
And in the record, was there any evidence that he had a hearing problem?
No, the prosecutor did elicit some testimony from the victim, you know, when you're speaking before with him, did he hear you, you know, was there any, you know, so there was clearly no evidence that he was hearing impaired, that the environment was incredibly loud, she didn't, you know, testify that her face was completely pressed into the mattress, you know, there's nothing that sort of would be the kind of circumstances that then could maybe support such a hypothesis. Instead, she said, a loud and clear voice, that there at no other point in time did he not understand her or hear her. If there are no further questions, the state would rest on its brief and respectfully request this court affirm.
Seeing none questions, thank you for your argument. We'll go ahead and, Marshall, please reset the clock for rebuttal to 5 minutes. And counsel, feel free again if you need to adjust. And also please announce again your name and the party you represent for the record.
Thank you, Judge. Christina Zahar for appellant Michael Lovestrand. Even applying the Hope Coalition and Ramirez cases, those cases both acknowledge that all privileges must sometimes give way to a criminal defendant's right to confront their accuser. Even unpierceable privileges by statute can be pierced if it affects the ability of the defendant to cross-examine their accuser. Both cases heavily return to the ability to cross-examine one's accuser. And the ability to cross-examine one's accuser is not simply to be present and ask her questions. We need to be able to effectively cross-examine an accuser with the information that they are presenting in their own testimony. In this case, the state opened the door and asked the victim about going to counseling and how that impacted her decision to report this. I agree with the court. One of the judges brought up that many sexual assault victims go to counseling, right? That's really common. But what distinguishes this case is not all victims say that they weren't sexually assaulted until they talk to their therapist and decide at therapy that they were. And then the state uses that evidence.
And is that in the record, or is this just argument?
No, that's in the record. She testified that
what she said, but your supposition about other crimsex cases.
Oh, no, that wouldn't be in the record.
That's what I thought.
That's just anecdotal, Judge.
Sorry, thank you.
Yeah,
sorry for interrupting.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
I think it's just, I think it comes up frequently enough in criminal sexual conduct cases that we have victims that go to counseling, and there's a lot of case law about seeking therapy records of sexual assault victims. So it is a very frequent topic that comes up. In this case, our ability to cross-examine...
Why does it matter, I guess, if the point you're making, you know, this is unusual that it's in counseling that she perceives that she was the victim of an assault. I don't think there's been a suggestion that counseling changed her perception about what happened, but there was a change in perception about what happened meant as a matter of law. Correct me if I'm wrong about that, and address the relevance of it, please.
I think that's fair to say, that characterization of it. And why it's relevant in this case, it was actually a very critical part of her testimony and part of her story that she presented to the jury through the state's direct examination of her. And that's what distinguishes this case, is that it's not just that the victim was going to counseling to, you know, deal with collateral issues that arose as a result of the assault, but the therapy was actually part of the evidence, part of the story, part of the timeline about what got this case into the courtroom and why it was in front of the jury.
That's why I'm wondering whether there was prejudice. And if that's the hook, if that's the concern, she changed her mind about not what happened, about how she felt about what happened, only about what it meant as a matter of law, what happened meant as a matter of law. Why would that be, how then do you show prejudice by the exclusion?
The prejudice is that two times in July of 2019, she denied being sexually assaulted. And that would have been important for us to be able to ask her about, to help piece together that timeline even further, given how close that was to the reporting of the offense. So it would allow us to talk about how she denied being sexually assaulted to the emergency room physician, which was allowed into evidence, but that she told additional professionals on later dates, again, that she had not been sexually assaulted.
But if you're saying that change that happened in therapy was not what happened, but her perception of the legal consequences of what happened, that's the part where I'm lost on. You're establishing prejudice. How would that information have helped her, have helped your client's defense?
Well, Judge, we'd be able to talk to her more about why she had that change of opinion and why she had that change of mind if we were able to have complete materials to cross-examine her with. And we'd be able to talk to her more about when that happened. Keep in mind she testified.
I don't know why that's relevant, that she had a change in mind about the law.
Well, she believed that that this was consensual. She believed it was consensual and just a negative sexual experience for well over a year since the alleged offense occurred, and that's really important information for the jury to have in a case like this that relies on her testimony, her credibility, and her story, her version about what happened. And so that's why it's important, and due process requires that the jury hear all relevant evidence.
I do have one question for you. In the record, just to refresh my memory, didn't your client have the opportunity to cross-examine and also question the complainant about her difficulty with remembering things, et cetera?
Correct.
So there was an opportunity to discuss that aspect of it, and wasn't there also an opportunity to discuss the change of her opinion about what happened?
Correct. We were able to discuss the change of her opinion.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys, everyone, for your briefing and for your argument here today. This has been very helpful. We will take this under advisement. The matter is submitted and issue an opinion within the 90-day time frame. And with that, our calendar has one more case on it. It's a non-oral case, so we are currently adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.